Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hello, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And if we sound a little echoey today, it's because we are coming to you from a most unusual museum in El Segundo, California, where they have devoted a huge space to one of pop culture's unsung heroes, Oscar winner Rick Carter, who has been the production designer working with Steven Spielberg, Robert Zemeckis, J.J. Abrams, and James Cameron, to name a few. And Rick Carter, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I love being here with you.
You've got one hell of a hit list, I'll say that. It's overwhelming to me to read the different things that you've worked on, you've actually lived the working on. Is it ever overwhelming to you to think about how much there is?
It's always overwhelming. I think to have been in the collaborative experience with these directors has allowed me to experience a kind of a high level of, well, just a high, because I love to visualize. And so when you're around those types of directors, something happens where you want to feed the movie that you're on with them, and they encourage you. And so for me, I'm always pushed to go as far as I can. That's the best part of the whole experience has been, they've all been so inviting to me and wanting to listen. And then whatever I could come up with, they make it better.
I was thinking about, being in this exhibit is pretty wild, and I really hope anybody who can get to it should, because it's...
You're not familiar with El Segundo. It's right near the airport.
It's right near LAX, so should you find yourself with a layover...
It's actually a very sweet town, and also home to the Old Town Music Hall,
yep.
A favorite place of mine, and this deceptively small... museum
from the
entrance.
Outside, and then you get inside.
It's
huge and it's beautiful. But
it's
you're showing us the Lincoln section, and I was thinking about on the ride over. So were you the one that got to create Daniel Day-Lewis's dressing room?
Oh,
was that part
you heard
of
about
you
this?
Oh, I don't think it's something you forget easily.
Well, Daniel is obviously a very unique person, and as an actor, he truly shapeshifts. He becomes the characters. And that's said about a number of people, but I had the experience of being able to engage him about 2 months before the production, when he was still Daniel Day-Lewis, coming by the set just to see what it was looking like as we were building the White House. And then 2 months later, him walking through the door as the president. And we all thought of him as the president. And in doing that, it allowed us to kind of time travel back with him. And all that he asked was to have as little bit of distraction as possible from the current time zone that he's in. So even his dressing room and the various places that he went were art directed, at least to some extent, so that he could feel comfortable being in the 1860s when we were doing it in the 2010s. And we did it very much because it's something we would want to do in creating a world for the actor who's willing to go that far. And if you think about it, and I hadn't really ever thought about it until that time, which was if he's willing to go this far with his own person to make that which is imaginary real, and I'm an art director and my whole art department is designed to do that, why wouldn't we try to meet him at least halfway and create the world, as much of the world as we possibly could, for him to inhabit and to act in?
What's it like when he comes back out?
Well, actually, I didn't see him back out until we were at a showing of the movie at the Bruin Theater in Westwood. And he walked up to me with a big grin. He said, "Rick, it's so good to see you." I started laughing. I said, "Well, I don't know who you are." because he's so much a person in character, but as his own real life, he's a different person, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He did, if you want me to tell you a little anecdote about that.
And we do.
Okay. I don't think that I'm saying anything that it's a secret, because it was actually spoken at the Bruin Theater when I was able to sit next to him, and he was asked the question of how did he find the character of Lincoln. And he started talking about how it was at first through the voice, because once he could get a dialect that he could speak Lincoln's words, then he could start to believe that he could perhaps play this character. But what was very interesting was, and I was looking at him just right next to him in profile, which was as he was addressing the audience, he said, and I don't think he speaks this way that often, meaning about his process.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he likened it to a metaphor, and he said, if it was like I was fishing, I was casting out a line to see if I could get a bite from Lincoln that would draw me towards him, and I would try to reel that fish in so that I could play Lincoln. And he said, but what was really interesting was at a certain point, and there was a transition for him, he was not aware anymore whether he was drawing Lincoln in or Lincoln was drawing him in.
Mm.
And you could feel that from him, because it was almost as though he was then in the service of conveying who Lincoln had been as best he could, which of course then gives it a future. You know, that whole presence that's come and gone in time then has another presence in the present tense with that role of Lincoln, and now we can even talk about it later. So I really got a lot from just being number one around him, but number two, having him speak so openly about what it was to do his artistic process, which is very inspirational.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
a complete commitment. It's every piece of him becomes that character.
Right.
And sometimes when you hear about method actors, you know, it can sound a bit like, really? Really, guys?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about your families? What about your lives? You know, do you have to do that? And some people don't.
Right.
But there are some people that do, and what they come back with blows you away. So if that's what it takes for him to find Abraham Lincoln, then...
I think that total commitment on his part, and many of the people that I've worked with's part, is why I've been so attracted to production design. Because I've gotten to bring so much of my whole being into what I do. Of course, I'm responsible for the world and the sets and the way that functions on a schedule, budget, and the aesthetics. But the other part of it is, that I've discovered over the years, is my own being as a traveler throughout my life, which I've done quite a bit of world travel, has gone into being the basis of why I can do production design. Because I can discover a sense of what I would call a spirit of place in reality, but then I can extract elements of that, and when I'm applying that to a setting, I'm creating then a setting with a large group of people, for creative people such as Steven Spielberg or Bob Zemeckis or Jim Cameron to come, and then they create in that space. So it's almost like the travel experience then coming out the other way as a baseline for other people to feel inspired. And that's something that I cherish.
Yeah.
Now, you've just shown us examples of your drawings from when you were 6 years old and 8 years old. And one is a portrait of Lincoln. And I mean, I love to draw. I always had a pencil or crayon in my hand. But I couldn't have done
little you
anything.
Already knew what you were doing,
yeah.
It looks like.
I couldn't have done anything even approaching what you do.
The unusual thing, I think, in that is that there's many people who can draw, and they, from an early age, the things that I was drawing at an early age, whether it be Abraham Lincoln or Dorothy or King Arthur or Davy Crockett or a pirate ship, the heroics that I was exposed to in the movies, the adventurous, romantic roles that I, even at a very early age, wanted to emulate in my own life, would make up fantasies. Of course, I was character-oriented, but that's actually, as it's turned out, only been half of the equation in my mind, because I have a far-sighted eye and a near-sighted eye. The near-sighted eye is the one that draws the people, and I have all these sketches and paintings I've done over my lifetime. But I also have partaken in this travel experience of creating backgrounds or worlds, so that the drawings, I didn't do, you know, fantasy scapes. I drew people. So that's always been my point of reference, is the people and the characters that go somewhere, what did they get from it? And then I learned how to create those worlds in all the mediums that we have, whether it's physically building it or digital. But I actually had to come to that not as the first thing. It's almost like the first thing that I ever knew how to do was to draw people and look in their eyes and in my mind or whatever it was that I was using as a reference. But then I had to go out and experience life, traveling on the road around the world. And then as a career, I got to go back out, whether it's physically or even into the digital realm, to create worlds that those people could inhabit. So many of the characters are actually on display here, I think, are like characters that reference that heroic journey that I got to imagine when I was young, or even helped to create. There's an image right above us here of Maz Kanata from Star Wars. Now, Maz with J.J. Abrams was created because we wanted a female version of a Yoda type of character. We were talking about who had inspired us. Well, it turns out we went to Palisades High School 17 years apart. We had the same English teacher named Rose Gilbert. So we modeled this character who was a short little woman with big goggles as eyeglasses, who taught us about existentialism and about being authentic. And that journey became something we discussed enough that we ended up saying, well, that's who the character should be. And that's how she appears in the movie.
Oh, my.
And she's such a great, that's why that painting is so great.
Yeah, J.J. bought that painting.
Did he? Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Jeez. There's another painting over here of Sinke from Amistad that one of the artists created, and that Debbie Allen, who was the producer of the movie Amistad, came in and she fell in love with that painting, so she bought that. She's going to put it up in her dance academy. So it's a nice full circle that can come from the experience of the movie back to some of the people that were instrumental in making it to begin with.
So, all right, so you're growing up. What did your parents do?
Well, the funny thing is my father was a publicist in the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
He worked in the studio system and then went out on his own as a public relations man. My mother helped him, and they had this sort of company together. And then my dad became partners with Jack Lemmon in the 60s at Jalem Production and helped produce Cool Hand Luke and some of the movies that went through Jalem. And then he ended up producing the movie that Jack directed called Koch with Walter Matthau. So I was around Hollywood quite a bit. Now, when I became a late teenager, I sort of struck out on my own and thought I probably wanted very little to do with Hollywood. But after going around the world, Hollywood looked pretty good to me.
Huh.
And I loved that I was able to be myself amongst the people that I discovered in Los Angeles, and I already knew a lot of the culture. I didn't have so many connections, but those that I made, I was able to make in a good way.
I have a theory for those of us from Los Angeles, born and raised in Los Angeles, is that you're either really creative and grateful for what you grew up around, or you run screaming the other direction.
Well, or you do both.
Yeah, little bit each.
I was of the 60s generation, so I left thinking I was running and screaming, and then, of course, like the prodigal son, came back and realized how much was here that actually was nowhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people don't around the world talk like people talk in Hollywood. People in Hollywood talk about their dreams as though they can make those dreams come true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ambition's a currency here.
Yeah. But part of that is that you can. I think that is what does it. I said this to a friend the other day. I said, isn't it crazy that whoever we want to meet in the world, if we really wanted to make it happen, we'd find a way? Mm-hmm. Like anybody you could list, mm-hmm. we'd find the right person to talk to who would send us to the right person to talk to, and we'd find a way to get to them. How many places have that kind of energy about them?
I have a theory about that, but please, Leonard, say.
Please tell us.
My theory would be that everybody who's here who has a dream at whatever level, Steven Spielberg is an outsider more than most all the people you know, even if he's the ultimate insider. There's a kind of a almost a Zen koan type of non-logical equation that goes into many of the people that are at the heart of this industry and this art form. And so there's kind of a gap that if you can find the end to that person's gap, they will let you in because it's serving their interest as well. And they might be interested in what your questions are because you actually bring up something that they get to, at least for that time, explore. And so that's kind of my theory as to why you can get to people, but you have to know how to do it that's sincere.
Yes.
And it has to be for something that where you're together making something bigger than the sum of the parts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, just a couple of nuts and bolts questions.
Yeah.
All right. So you could draw. That was a gift that you were born with.
Yeah.
And over time, you refined your skills, your abilities. But production design is very specific. It calls on architecture. It calls on.
What'd you say? You're creating a world.
Yeah.
You're creating
world
an
building,
entire world.
They call it now.
Yeah.
You know, it calls on so many different skills, and not to mention administrative skills.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you're also a boss.
You have to delegate to all the right people.
How did you acquire those skills?
Well, you know, in some ways, again, like what we were just talking about, it comes from the opposite, which is it's a deficit if you don't have those skills. So my skills were in drawing people, not in backgrounds, not in architecture, not in set decoration. So those have never been the skills that I had, and certainly not digital imagery or the digital world. So what I did learn about as an artist who could draw people, however, was an aspect of what the creative process was for me. And it could be very specific just as a drawing and say, well, I'm drawing eyes. I'm trying to penetrate into the inner workings of the mind as expressed in what a face would look like. How does that help you build a world? Well, then it leads to a type of dialogue I could have with an artist. And the artist might be expressing something that relates to a world or a landscape or a building, but I try to get into the dialogue with them as to what actually they can relate to and what skills they can bring to bear and how that can fit into the movie, and that the movie ultimately is a story that has to relate back to people. So it has to be relatable. So the filter that I'm probably putting on all of this, which is probably the one talent I would have, is as the filter, along with being somebody who can inspire people to find what they can bring to it. So then the collaborative process of becoming a production designer, whether it's to create the aesthetic, have the dialogue with the director, come in on time, come in on budget, all those elements, there's a collaborative component. So I'm really listening to people, I'm putting it through my own ideas, and ultimately I think that's how I made that transition, to not try to do everything. So actually when the revolution in digital imagery came about at the end of the 1990s into the 2000s, I had none of the skill set that could allow me to go forward, except I never had the skill set. So the people that actually knew how to do everything were caught because in many ways they had to learn to redo a whole skill set that they had developed a whole career about. I was always trying to work with people and to bring out what they could do. My mentor, or one of them, Richard Silbert, who had designed Chinatown and Rosemary's Baby and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he would call people like me hummers, because he could play all the instruments and he could write the music, but we could only hum the tune. And when I came into that equation in the early 70s, I said to myself, well, I'm going to take that a step further. I'm going to become an air guitarist, meaning I'm just going to look like I'm playing the guitar. And in doing that, I actually found a way to make people laugh. And then they would open up to helping me to create whatever we were creating. Then the magical thing happened, which was you get a few of these movies under your belt, and people take you a little bit seriously. And if the director is willing to take you seriously, then they don't mess with you as much.
Right.
And that started to help me to get even looser and freer in saying basically a very fundamental, which is, I cannot do what you do. I need you, so let's work together to make this happen. There's many people who know how to do lots of things, but then they'll put it through their filter all the time. And then they limit what other people can contribute. Whereas Steven Spielberg is so open, actually, for all that he knows about what the movie is that he's making and all that he knows how to do. One of my favorite expressions, and it's actually on the wall here, I wrote it, which was that one time I came up with an idea that he really liked. And it was more than one, but he said, well, that just means that some of my best ideas are not my own. Because he's open to taking that on.
Right.
And then once it becomes a part of his movie, it is one of his ideas.
Sure.
Yeah.
But he's open to bringing that. He doesn't always have to have the idea in an immaculate form. Or sometimes it takes a different form. Robert Zemeckis, one of the things I loved about working, I'll call him Bob because that's how I know of him, is I would start talking about whatever idea I had for some scene or set, and he would listen for a few moments, and his eyes would start to bulge out, and he would say, what I thought you were gonna say is, then he'd go into a whole idea that could go right into the movie exactly as he just said it, and then I would say, well, were you already thinking about that? And he said, no, just as you started talking. So that means that, like, in nanoseconds, he's conceptualizing something that was there to be had, but it happened because there was a level, almost like as if I was a reconnoiter out saying, what about this? And he's quickly going, no, not there, not this, but I think this, because you took me to the level. And then he would make it and go even higher. So that collaborative process is not just iterative, it's explosive. It's like the Big Bang Theory. And whenever he would come upon, obstacles that, like, were just, how we get past this, he would say, well, that's another insurmountable opportunity. And it was like that.
That's a great turn of phrase. I like that.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's been interesting. If you spend time, even just small amounts with these sort of giants, the directors that you're talking about specifically, something that I noticed even when I was younger was they were really nice. Mm-hmm. They were warm. They tended to be, I mean, Spielberg especially. I don't think you would have any idea who he was if you didn't know who he was.
Right.
Because he just comes off as this nice man, you know? And I think that that's part of the success, is that if that's how he comes across to me, a stranger who can do nothing for him, you know? I serve no purpose. Mm-hmm. If that's how you're going to treat me, especially when I'm younger.
Sure.
That tells me a lot about why people want to work for you and why they want to give you their best. Because if that's the kind of way that you are, you open it up.
I have found that. That's certainly true with Steven and Bob and Jim and JJ. They're all different versions of that.
Mm-hmm.
So Steven's his own special version that is... You know, he's a mensch. I mean, he really is a good guy. And it comes across in his movies. His process is appreciative. You want to help, but also because it ends up going somewhere that you not only feel purposeful, you feel like you've had some part of it that's being acknowledged. Bob is very much the same way and is explosive in that kind of inspirational quality that he can bring. Like you know, if you think about Doc Brown and Lightning, and you put those two together, you kind of have, or even Forrest Gump, who's not intellectually smart, but is explosive with his heart in terms of how he solves a problem and does the right thing. Jim's different because he's that, except he can do everybody's job. So then he can be in a situation where he's like such a good artist himself that to have other people not get it quite right is a little bit painful for him, but he's also trying to do something that has never been done before.
Right.
And that could be on the subject matter level of being at the bottom of the ocean with the Titanic, seen by a luminescent life, and wanting to bring that to the surface in a cinematic form. How does he make a life form that's on another planet that reflects what he actually saw, and how does he convey that? And what colors should that be? How should that come across? And then you combine that with the other side that's in him, which is this kind of power of the, like a militarism, that can actually be in battle with that other force, that spiritual force of Ewa. And when you're in that dynamic with him, what I find is that there's this gap between those two that he's really interested in trying to make those two come together. So when I found that I could mine that gap with him, which is what I was saying before, you find the way in, he was extremely open because he wants that to be bridged. So the defenses that go out the other way actually are designed as a way to keep the castle together.
Yeah.
But the castle has a split, so you have to find that way that the moat, it doesn't just go around, but goes in, and now you're in the center of it. J.J. Abrams, who's younger, one of the things I loved about working with him is he's such a kid about it, and he is 17 years younger than myself. So he'll just say things like, well, a bad version of the idea is just to get it out.
Sure,
and
sure,
then,
sure.
And then often it's not a bad idea at all. It just may be slightly half-baked or need an association with something. And then in that kind of way, I found that each one of them has a warmth, that all those movies I've gotten to work on with those directors, and that's really been the sum of my career, I find that there's a warmth and there's a heroism at the basis of it. So that provides a kind of feeling that I have about the movies, not only while I'm working on them, but afterwards, even if they don't fully succeed,
yeah.
I know that they're for a good purpose.
Well, Steven Spielberg has, I'm sure you've completed The Fablemans.
Yes.
It's going to come out this fall, and it's his first openly autobiographical movie.
Yeah.
And I don't want to read too much about it.
Right.
I want to know very little. I want just want to go and see it and have
good.
It, you know, work its spell.
What I can say is, without giving anything away, only mostly about process, is that at this stage of life, if there's been any benefit of the pandemic, which is a hard one to say that there would be, for all the suffering it's caused and the trauma. But for Stephen and some of us, it forced a type of reflection.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
About our lives and the values. And so the things that may come out of it are closer to a heartfelt or purposeful manifestation of what we actually care about, and wanting to do it while we can.
Yeah.
And I think that the Fablemans has that aspect to it.
Talk about the first time you met Stephen, please.
I was working on the movie Goonies. I was the art director with Michael Riva. And the two of us were like two kids in a candy shop. Nobody knew what we were doing. We were building pirate ships and caves. And it was like being paid to be a swashbuckler. And I would have wanted that job when I was 10. I mean, that's why the pirate ship drawing when I was 4, and then seeing the Goonies ship, it was a 30-year journey to actually get to do that. But I was on that movie. It was being executive produced by Stephen and Kathy Kennedy. It was Stephen's idea, his story, about the kids going to find a pirate ship. And Michael Riva and Dick Donner, the director, who was this wonderful, expansive presence amongst all of us, and they were on location, and Stephen wanted to come by and see the pirate ship. So what I said was I'd be happy to take him around, of course. We had like 8 stages, and I took him on a tour. I didn't start with the pirate ship. I started in order with the lighthouse interior set, and then went down into the caves and took him as though we were on Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, so I was doing it the way I was experiencing that movie. And he really enjoyed going through the whole cave system and step by step from one stage to another. And then we finally got to the pirate ship, and what they had done to keep people from the outside to look in and see, they'd put a big curtain up. So I actually got to do a curtain reveal for Stephen and Kathy of this partially built ship. And it was fantastic because there was the physical manifestation of somebody that had only been in his head.
Right.
And I think that just delighted him. And he was coming up with this TV series the following year, Amazing Stories. So that led to him asking me if I wanted to be a production designer on that, which for me was, of course, just fantastic because now I got a whole kaleidoscope of stories to tell over 2 years. And as adventurous as that could be, fit with where I was. You know, I was just a kid living a pirate's dream.
Hmm. I can't imagine that being the first time someone says, do you build pirate land?
Yeah.
It's like, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't twist my, like, really? That's
and also, we didn't know what we were doing. Like, even the industry didn't really know what it was doing at that point, to be honest. The 70s had so taken away the studio system and all the craftsmanship. We had trouble finding people who could draft a ship.
Right.
We couldn't. Michael and I couldn't. We finally found someone to do that. The rock walls, we had to find our way back, bring people out of retirement to show how to do the plaster work.
Wow.
No one knew how to do it. And so then, and Michael Riva as a production designer was so free and expansive. Just to give you an example, can you imagine that you've built a set, which is one of the cave sets in that movie, and then he had this idea that there should be a transition of how they get into the final cave, but it should be like a slide. You know, and everybody, well, okay, fine, but how are we going to do that? And there's no digital imagery in those days. So Michael called a slide-making company for theme parks, and they came in and they built a slide above the fire line in the stage 8 feet up so it wasn't interfering with the fire line. And that's how that scene was created. You went up a ladder and then actually went down a slide and then landed in a pond that was in that stage. But that's the kind of way we were making the movie, and that was probably only, I want to say, 8 weeks from shooting. And that's how crazy it was.
Please tell me you went down that slide.
Oh, of course.
Just checking. Oh,
of course.
I just have to ask.
It was fantastic.
That's so cool.
That's great. The first features you worked on were Back to the Future 2 and 3.
Right.
And what I retain most from 3 is Monument Valley.
Right.
And the railroad train.
Yeah.
Spectacular railroad train.
Yeah.
Where'd you find the train?
Well, that was up in Sonora, in Northern California, and it was a period train. Fortunately, you know, in an area where we actually were able to build a western town that could look like Hill Valley, and so we built a whole western town right near the track that was already there.
Oh my!
And then
another fantasy come true.
Oh my! To build a western town and have a train, and then the ultimate, which you could never do now and probably shouldn't do now, maybe shouldn't have done then, but that is to build a drive-in theater in Monument Valley. I mean, so I got to go into Monument Valley. We were very environmentally conscious about taking the topsoil away and then bringing it back and all the things that we could do so you couldn't tell even after we were gone that what had happened. But we built this actual drive-in theater in the middle of Monument Valley amongst all the people there. And so I got to go in and out of that while doing the future and the 1985 version of Hill Valley in Universal, and then building the town and then going. So I did this triangle and I would just travel around.
Love it.
We'd back-to-back movies. They weren't done that way. You know, so we didn't even know we were going to Monument Valley when we started. And we were shooting on the, we just knew we needed a transition, and Bob came up with this idea that we had to go to Monument Valley so that we could have that iconography in the movie.
That's wow. Iconography is the word, and that's why sitting in this space, so I need the audience who cannot see to understand that me and our engineer Aristotle are sitting on the Forrest Gump bench. Next to me is a box of See's candy that does actually feel full and is not attached to the bench, though it should be, because I'm pretty sure that's the first thing that's getting taken. But I'm staring at all of these different images that are a part of your life, whether you've even if you haven't seen some of the movies, even if someone hasn't seen something, they will recognize this. So I'm looking at all these different images of Tom Hanks doing many, many, many different things.
Castaway.
Castaway is over there, and he's standing with Jenny in front of the bus over there.
Or Forrest Gump.
Above that, though, is Doc. You know, and next to that is a DeLorean with the Out of Time behind it. And you have the Shackles over there, which I'm guessing is part of this.
Amistad.
Of part of Amistad. You've got,
there's War Horse.
But my mother's from the Bronx. We say War Horse.
War Horse.
You got War Horse over there. It's just, and then you've got the various Star Wars imagery. It really is, and of course Jurassic Park. It's overwhelming because it is all these things that I would think most people could recognize almost anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that is.
Well, there's something about my experience of this show which I would want to convey, which is it's not just about the movies when they came out and how people saw them at that time or how you might classify them with the director or the genre or the sequels that might have, you know, come after them. But it's the artists that came in, the eight street muralists who came in that were provided by Esmoa, the museum here, and they came in and basically were inspired by and tripped out painting on fabric, ideas and iconography and philosophies that came from the movies. And then the process that I got to go through with them, which is not people I knew ahead of time, but to find what actually involved them personally. What of any of this, what do you pick?
Mm.
So for instance, some of the things that you just mentioned, and without getting too specific, but I just want to mention just a couple quickly, was the portrait here of Jenny and Forrest. That was because the artist, when I asked him what he could relate to, said that he had a woman in his life that reminded him of Jenny. And I said, well, why don't you paint that? And so he painted this portrait of Jenny and Forrest. She looks like a ghost.
Yeah.
And then he painted this next image over here of Forrest at the grave of Jenny. And she's asking a very fundamental question here. I mean, he is. Which is life random like the feather, or is it predetermined? And that maybe it's a little bit of both. So that kind of was, for him, a kind of a process. Then another artist painted, Chuck Nolan or Tom Hanks in Castaway, and even Wilson. For me, those are the same character.
They are
connected in time by less than a decade, and they're both very lonely figures, if you think about it. They're existential feelings about what is the value of their life, what are they living for? That happens in Castaway, it happens in Forrest Gump. There's actual philosophy that all these artists, the directors and the artists came together about, and then they express them in these works that you see.
Well, how many artists altogether?
Eight different artists.
And they've done this work in a variety of media.
Yeah.
The fabric is so, I've never seen anything quite like that.
That was the curator, Bernard Zünkler. His vision is what you see here. He's the one who understood what he wanted to do in relationship to the body of work that he felt that I had done, that there was an emotional quality that I've experienced and expressed in time, my own personal time and the time within the movies, whether it's going back to a mosquito in prehistoric times or 2,000 years forward in AI, or a long time ago, far, far away, wherever that is. But there was something about wanting to take the kind of archive that's in my studio or in my house and put that in spotlights, which is what you see in these six spotlights of, well, that's my work, how I see things. Hanging from the ceiling are these portraits or my version of people that I've drawn my entire life. But to fill this out and to really make it come alive, it takes all the artists in the present time going down into the real world, which in this case is the garment district, picking out fabric that's already in our lives and taking the spray paint that they already know how to use and start to spray paint the imagery. So actually a lot of the quality of what you see is because these colors and patterns are already now part of our culture.
Right.
They're not even the cinephile level. It's like the fabric of our culture, and it's in El Segundo because it's kind of like a second life for the movies.
Mm.
You know, and there's just something that came together, and where you are sitting on the gump bench, it's a reflective bench. It's been in my backyard for all these years.
Has it really?
Yeah, and so here it is. You're just reflecting like Forrest Gump is on his life. You know, I mean, it's like a box of chocolates. That's why there are chocolates in that box. You know, and you can take one when you come here. You can have a seized candy.
Well, it says something about the caliber of films that you've worked on.
Yeah.
That they have seeped into the culture.
Right, right.
It's not just a movie that was a hit movie and made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Films like Forrest Gump and Back to the Future and its sequels, and certainly Jurassic Park, these are milestone
mm-hmm.
movies that are part of our lives,
yeah.
part of our history, part of our memory, and that's another reason that this exhibit works,
mm-hmm.
is because I mean if you hadn't worked on such good movies.
Yeah. but you have an emotional reaction when you walk
yeah.
in because you are seeing all of these pieces. I say you, I'm sure you have a very different emotional reaction because this is many years of your life. But that's what it feels like to walk into it, is you're sort of staring at everything and going, oh my God, it's this, it's this. The incredible image to my left from AI. I'm a sap.
Mm-hmm.
And that teddy bear throughout the film, I'm one of those people that cries
yeah.
when the teddy bear's alone, things like
yeah.
that. I am very okay with it. I cry really. My dad says he cries at supermarket openings.
Yeah.
I'm an easy crier.
Yeah.
I look at that and it makes me emotional because yeah. it's such a perfect, you know, moment from that film. And the thing is, beyond all of that, whether you like a movie or not, whether you like Amistad or you don't, or you like Castaway or you don't, the imagery is still something that you recognize.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And go on.
I was going to ask about the original Jurassic Park. I have to now qualify it.
Yes.
Yeah. Call it the original Jurassic Park. It would have been whose decision to shoot in Hawaii?
Well, I'm certainly the one who found Hawaii to shoot in.
That's what I'm asking.
Well yeah. done, young man. Well done.
You know, some of it is, as a production designer, you look to what you would like. Sometimes you have to go where you can do it. In those days, going to Costa Rica was not something that we could do.
No.
Hawaii is a pretty wonderful place, and particularly at that time, had not been shot very much recently, and Kauai was particularly spectacular. So going to Hawaii actually came about pretty easily, where to shoot things and how to make it all work. That's part of the production design
mm-hmm.
Purview, and I spent a lot of time, you know, scouting and figuring that out. One of the things that's interesting to me about both Jurassic Park, but in general, going to an other world, particularly if it's not going to be digital, is what type of feeling do you get from it? So, for instance, in Hawaii, there's a lot of wonderful volcanic kind of roughness, but how you use it matters too. So if you, for instance, if you think about where would you, if you had a park, land a helicopter, you would not land it next to a waterfall if you
no.
happen to have all that wide open space. But for the quality of the entrance into Jurassic Park, we knew we wanted to be there. We had to actually build the landing pad, and it got flooded. So it would have been the most ridiculous place.
Huh.
But to understand that that's still the type of jump you can make, because the audiences want that. They
yeah.
expect it.
Mm-hmm.
To give you another example of something like that but relates to Jurassic Park is that in the sequel, Lost World, you know, this island's also supposed to be off the coast of Costa Rica. But we couldn't find any place other than Hawaii, and we didn't want to go back to Hawaii. And I knew that I wanted, if possible, to have big, large trees, because that would have a power to what the story sort of demanded in terms of the prehistoric dinosaurs running wild on the island. And so I knew about the redwoods, of course, up in Northern California, but how do you justify redwoods down by Costa Rica?
Right.
Now, what I did when I came back from scouting and I showed all these pictures of the redwoods to Stephen, who loved them, but I said, of course, you know, these are redwoods and we're in the tropical zone. And he goes, that is a problem. And I said, well, I have a way out of that. What if you just blame it on me and you say, because I say that I just got it wrong. You said you wanted to be off the coast of Costa Rica. I thought you said close to Eureka. And so that's how we justified having those redwood trees in Lost World. And nobody to this day has ever blinked and said, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think when you're watching a movie about a dinosaur park, I would hope that the first thing we said is not, you know, there are redwoods there, and I'm not sure if you're aware, but those don't grow in Costa Rica, okay?
I think that's good old-fashioned dramatic license,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, you're allowed.
Well, you know, it's funny because production design as a pursuit is so intrinsically linked to the suspension of disbelief.
Of course.
That you can't see what a production designer does, and if you do, you're not in the movie.
Mm.
So you don't actually want to. It's like a magic trick. You're mm-hmm. working against what you want to have happen if you're noticing. And if you're noticing, you start to be, you know, you can admire it, but that doesn't mean that you're in the movie anymore.
Right.
So if, as was said to me by Dick Silbert, my mentor, I had wanted to be in a field where someone would know what I did, don't pick production design.
Right.
Because he would say no one will ever know because they don't want to know. And they shouldn't know.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a fun area to be in when you realize that it's a bit of a mystery. And you're trying to, in particular on some movies such as these, particularly Avatar, by the way, it's not just a suspension of disbelief, it's an invitation to believe. Because if you actually think about that movie and what's there that Jim pulled off so effortlessly, seemingly, I mean, obviously technically difficult, but to be about a story about a cripple who's in an MRI machine, has electrodes somewhere around him, and his whole being and consciousness is projected into another 9-foot-tall avatar that now can run around on the island, even when it's separated, like but when he's in a trailer and wherever it goes, and yet the whole transition is just down to a red, yellow, and a blue kind of 1960s trip, and you make that jump. You make the jump from what you think is essentially the world of Kansas, meaning where humans can breathe,
right,
into the Oz, which is out there in Pandora, and you want to believe that. Otherwise, you would just throw up way too many obstacles. But that's what the production design is partly in charge of and trying to do, which is to create the verisimilitude that a process there could happen.
We were lucky enough to speak to Caleb Deschanel a while ago because he had worked on the live-action Lion King and was talking about, because we said how, I mean, like, you doing production design on movies that are CG animated, people wouldn't necessarily think about that existing. What do you mean you have to, but you draw the whole thing? Well, but someone has to come up with what it looks like.
Right.
And he talked about having the virtual reality goggles on, sitting with Jon Favreau, and that they were walking around together by Pride Rock.
Yeah.
I thought, what a strange but incredibly cool moment.
Yeah.
That this is what you can do now. And
well, I love the fact that you just referred to it as live action. Now, the live action is in the acting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? But you've already accepted the digital manifestation as real enough, which is actually the transition that Jake makes in Avatar, because he actually renounces us, humankind, our species, to go join this other, more humane version of ourselves that actually turns out to be all digital. That's pretty wild when you think about the form and the content of movies crossing somewhere, so that then the live action compared to what's animation, which kind of is real, and how we perceive it. And that's where the emotion comes in, because if you identify, you know, with the emotions of characters, that they express what you care about and they have those values, then that's where you'll go. That's what the movie going experience is about. And even for production designers, really, the issue is not how to make fancy things. It's about how to support whatever it is that matters to the audience.
When you were asked to work on what is essentially a reboot of Star Wars with J.J. Abrams, did you have any hesitation? Because you'd be revisiting something that was very fixed in people's minds.
For me, what was fantastic about the whole experience was I was old enough to have already been working on movies, Hal Ashby movies, in the early 70s, so that when Star Wars came out, I'd already not only worked on movies, I had traveled around the world a couple of times and was a traveler. So see the expansive world that George brought into being in Star Wars just blew my mind. I mean, I didn't know that movies could do that. And all these years later, after the prequels, and then even further now into the, you know, what was the 2000, whatever it was, 12 or something, I was called by Kathy Kennedy to see if I would help Lucasfilm reboot that whole series. But going not after, what I kept saying to everybody was, remember, this episode takes place after number 6. It's number 7. It's not after number 3, even though number 3 came out last. Mm-hmm. That's just having a Back to the Future mind. Mm-hmm. Right, they can go back and forth, and now you orient yourself in the present tense, but where are you? Are you in an alternate reality? What are you? We knew that we wanted to follow number 6, so the aesthetics would be that. But what was important to me was the Force, and that's why I was always asking the artists when we first got together, how strong is the Force? This is not something you can answer just by talking about it. It's like we have to show where could we go with this. So we built up quite a catalog of ideas that I thought were very potent for what the Force could mean to characters in a new world that would be worthy of telling another set of movies. So I was never really reticent as much as I looked at it as an opportunity, especially since I was already older, to pass on something that I knew about the Force. Because actually, when I started, I asked Steven Spielberg, what is the Force? You were around George. And it was interesting because he just very quickly said, well, to him, it's intuition. That the actual, what you feel like when you're in touch with your intuition and it giving you a flow or connection, that's what the Force is. So I took that and kind of ran with it. Mm. My sense of the Force was, what does it manifest between people that makes it different and for the most part better, although it brings up problems, than it would otherwise? What, for instance, one of the types of things that we did was we asked ourselves, and this was in a room with all the people, the artists, including though Dennis Muir and some of the people who'd been there for the original ones, and I just asked, what would actually frighten you deeply if the dark side was returning in relationship to the Star Wars world? And it was Dennis Muren who said, well, if the dark side could take a light out of a star, that would be pretty threatening, and metaphorically would be right in line with how to manifest that. Well, that's what's actually at stake in The Force Awakens, number 7, is that the dark side has learned to extract light from the sky, and then as J.J. then turned it, to weaponize it. Hmm. So I thought that was worthy, and yet you never even notice that in the movie. You don't even think about that that's actually, but you have to ask that question if you're constructing a plot. What is the dark side actually doing? Well, that's what they're doing, and that's what the whole resistance is against. It's great to be there in the beginning before it's all figured out, right?
Yeah.
And you just come up with stuff like that, and it's an idea without even an illustration to it at that point.
It's so much creativity, and it's so much fun to think about the possibilities.
Yeah,
you know, and say you work with wonderfully talented people, you're all right yourself.
Thank you.
And you know, it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah. Well, for me, it has been.
You know,
I should knock on wood, but at this point, on the Gump bench. I mean, I know it's a little bit of predestination and a little bit of randomness, like the feather, but I think that I actually have enjoyed all the movies I've worked on. That, I mean, many people say that, but I have not had a bad experience. I haven't gotten beaten up. I had 20 years in the beginning just of Stephen and Bob, and they were supportive.
Yeah.
They just encouraged me to keep going.
Say, that's part of what makes them so special.
I think so.
Truly,
I think
you know, so. And it's why they make the movies that they do.
Yeah.
I was very, not envious, but I was, I felt at one with you when you recreated the look and feel of an old-style newspaper for the Post for Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Because when I went to NYU many years ago, we had a daily newspaper, and it was in the late 60s, and I got to go to a linotype shop and supervise one night a week. So I came in at the tail end of that old, old but reliable technology. And I may have heard you. It was a Q&A after a screening of the Post that you found a still intact working linotype shop
next to the studio that we were shooting in Brooklyn. I mean, it was. I mean, believe me, we put out like right at first, like, well, where are we going to do this? And you know, in all points bulletin goes out across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this museum here, and there's this, and oh yeah, there's right this, but that's just right. That's we could walk there. and the thing that was amazing, truly amazing about that, is the process itself. Well, first of all, it's such a great metaphor for film. The old mechanical, you
right.
see it, it's right there. You can understand. You know, it's like the emulsion is like the lead
mm-hmm. yeah.
in the printmaking process. But to see it happen, where they're setting this type and it's molten lead
yeah.
and then it freezes or whatever it does, it solidifies, and now that's the type. And then if they want to make changes, or the amount of ability to get it right and then to have it just show up on your doorstep as a newspaper in the morning mm-hmm. that you rely on mm-hmm. and when you see the amount of mechanical process that people went through just to deliver that. I mean, you know, we talk about the, you know, some of us who are a lot older, but, you know, the whole idea of the you know, Wells Fargo and the mail and the post office and all of that, the sleet and snow and getting it done. But to turn out a newspaper as reliably yeah. as has been done in our history and have that be the process is truly astounding. And then right next to it, where we were building the set was, it was not the set, for that part, it was a location, but the newsroom itself was so great because we just got to go into a building, make a place so that Stephen could literally just come to work.
Mm.
He just every time the call sheet would just bring him to the newsroom and shoot his scenes. So it was very much about trying to recapture a time, but as though it was a time that we were familiar with because it had mattered to us.
Yeah.
And also I think in some ways we associated that analog experience with telling the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And authentic.
Yeah.
Did you, when we were young, they took us all to the LA Times building. Mm-hmm. When we were kids, our school took us to the LA Times. And I will never forget watching it go through all of the various yeah. twists and turns that it does and thinking how incredibly cool that was. I have no idea if they do that with kids now. I mean, the newspapers are so thin.
Yeah.
But it was wild to watch it happen because it was still by hand. It
yeah.
still required humans.
Yeah.
And it's
it's a mechanical process
yeah.
that you visualize.
Cause and effect.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's right.
Mechanical. That's when I first showed my daughter how to thread a projector, a 16-millimeter projector.
Yeah. I was a year and a half. I didn't really get it.
There was a relationship from one frame to the next.
Yeah.
You know, it's things like that.
I still don't understand how music comes out of it. I think that's witchcraft. Same with records. That's yeah. witchcraft, I swear.
Well, it's funny. We just talked about the music and film. This is going to sound like a non sequitur, but it's sort of related, is when I was on Back to the Future 2 with Bob Zemeckis, and we were in a cave set where the DeLorean had been stashed, and Dean Cundey, the cinematographer, was there. And Bob was looking at the set, and then he turns to Dean, and he says, well, we're in a cave. Where's the light going to come from? And Dean, without skipping a beat, said, the same place as the music. But that kind of cause and effect,
absolutely.
Meaning that's the jump.
Absolutely.
But I think that that's part of the mechanical processes that we inherently can recognize, and that's why with digital imagery, it's more difficult because it's doing something we can't see and maybe we don't even fully comprehend. There's a kind of a secret at the base, not secret, but it's at the fundamental elemental level of digital, which is that the great thing is you can do anything. The hard thing is you have to do everything. So you're constructing things that normally, if you were just photographing them, you would work with them and you respond. That's why Stephen, in particular, less than Bob and less than Jim, but likes to have tangible things in the set that he can relate to so that he's finding his point of view, his shots. They're not just cool shots. The point of view that he wants to the characters is in relationship to what their physical environment is. And there's a cause and effect there that's tangible to him. He's very, very aware of his eyes being the camera and that he needs to feel something about it.
They say that's part of why what he makes is what it is.
Yeah.
It's very personal and it's very special. Rick, thank you so much.
We're so grateful to you.
Bringing us here. And
yes.
For giving us your time, we're really grateful.
By the way, the name of this exhibit is Time.
Yeah.
And we won't start to discuss, that'll be another whole conversation about the meaning of the word time and the meanings, multiple meanings of the word time. But you've given us a piece of your time today and have given us food for thought that will extend into the time.
Just keep using every drink every time he says time. Do a shot every time he says time.
That'll work.
This is incredible. Yeah. It's beautiful.
And again, we're at
the El Segundo Museum of Art. ESMOA rolls off the tongue with a thud. ESMOA. But it's very cool, and the street that it's on, this Main Street, really does look like Main Street, USA.
I know.
It's so sweet, and just driving in, I said, it's like, I want to hang out here.
Worth the trip.
It is. It absolutely is.
My goodness. And, Jesse, where do people find us?
Here, apparently. No, you are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You can also find my dad on Facebook. You can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups, and you've got two book roundups right now that are excellent, and the Patreon.
And then there's the Patreon, patreon.com/maltinonmovies, if you want to contribute something to keep us going, which is what we all need, something to keep us going. Who couldn't use a little support there? And we can thank you in various ways. So go to patreon.com/maltinonmovies. And thank you all for being here. Thank you again, Rick. And we'll see you folks next week. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.